and welcome to the 11th episode of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My usual co-host, Perry Middlemiss, is still overseas. He's just been to the Dublin World Science Fiction Convention, and he's been travelling around Europe, visiting places as far apart as Iceland and the south of France, where he's currently sunning himself. But my good friend Kerry Hanfield has kindly agreed to help me co-host again, and so he's here with me. Hi, Kerry.
Hello, David.
How's things?
I'm going very well, thank you.
That's good. This episode, we're going to be looking again at AussieCon, the first World Science Fiction Convention to be held in Australia in 1975, which is an amazing 44 years ago. So we'll be discussing a number of things to do with that, and we have a number of interviews which we'll bring you shortly, in which we interview various people about their experiences of AussieCon. But I thought we might start a bit closer to home. Kerry, we've already got you on record. We did an interview with you and Perry before Perry went overseas. And we've also got the interview with Perry himself before he went overseas, talking about his experiences of AussieCon. But I guess I should talk about my own experiences of AussieCon.
David, what was your role?
My role was a very scary one, really. I found it very stressful. It was actually looking after the Hugo Awards.
It's now my miserable pleasure to invite the entire awards committee for this convention to join me on the platform. Mr. David Rick.
And that involved issuing the ballots, counting the ballots, adding up all the totals, working out who'd won, and organising the actual physical awards. Now, I believe that the awards themselves are in the form of a rocket ship on a base, and the base can vary from Wilcon to Wilcon, but there's a fairly standardised version of the rocket ship, which is the main part of the award. Kerry's just informed me he knows who made those
for
rocket
a
ships.
For a number of years, a British fan, Pete Weston, made the rockets. I think he was an engineer and had a connection to a foundry, and I know he made the rockets for AussieCon in 75 and for a number of other world cons, both before and after AussieCon.
Yeah, well, that's very good to know. I didn't know that. But all I remember is that I had to organise the bases on which these rocket ships would be mounted. And in fact, it was just some little sports award shop in Flinders Lane in the city that I went to, kind of place that makes awards for cricket clubs and football clubs and so on, and had them make up these awards for the Hugos. But I do remember being absolutely paranoid about the security around the Hugos, and I felt I wasn't able to let anyone else know who'd won, which is in retrospect a bit silly. And it did cause some embarrassment. There was one particular person who was there, who was coming to the convention, who had been asked by several people to take awards for them if they won. And he asked me to make sure that when he got his award, it would be after all this string of other awards he'd had to pick up for other people. The only problem was, of course, he hadn't actually won, and it was a bit embarrassing for both him and for me, but... there we go. What else do I remember about the Hugos? Well, the main thing I remember, of course, about AussieCon is the Hugos, because that was my main responsibility.
And any panel items?
And I think I was on a couple of panel items. Certainly I remember being on a panel item with Ursula Le Guin, in which we were talking about dragons, metaphorical dragons rather than real dragons. So, and that's probably on tape somewhere. Kerry, you've got a whole bunch of... tapes or DVDs of tapes that were made at the commission. Now, tell us a little bit about that, because we didn't actually capture that in a previous episode. Who was responsible for those?
Basically, we got the whole convention set, produced on videotape. The person who organised it at the time was Don Ashby. He was a teacher, but he had connections with a local Melbourne Teachers College. And basically, he got about 10 of his friends and fellow students from the college who had some technical expertise in producing videos to come along. And we hired the state-of-the-art equipment. as I say, state of the art. It was reel to reel. The cameras were very large, and basically they aimed to produce as much of the convention as possible.
Mm.
And it ranged from a lot of the panel items. It ranged from the guests of honor speeches down to they did some roving reporting at some of the room parties late at night, which produced some rather interesting footage. And it ended up producing, I don't know, 15 to 20 tapes, reel-to-reel tapes. About 20 years after the convention, the quality, the condition of these tapes started to deteriorate. So the Australian Science Fiction Foundation raised some funds to transfer the tapes onto DVDs at a great cost, and about four or five sets were made, and they were sold to a couple of fans. I've got one set which David has been looking at over the last month or so.
Extracting a few things from them. But their quality isn't great now. It's a pity. I mean, really, it's a pity that those original reel-to-reel tapes, the quality of those originally was probably top-notch.
It was.
But it looks now it looks like, the, as you say, the tapes were deteriorating.
Mm.
It looks like they were transferred probably to VHS and then eventually to DVD, so that the quality is pretty poor. Really.
Sure.
But it's a pity.
It is, but even allowing a poor quality, they're an interesting historical record.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a unique, really. There's no way of getting back to that event without looking at what we've got, which is all we've got. But that's interesting. Now, you mentioned the Australian Science Fiction Foundation. I don't think we've actually covered that in the podcast so far. So you're the chairman of
the... I'm the treasurer.
You're the treasurer of the Australian Science Fiction Foundation. So what is the Australian Science Fiction Foundation and when did it start?
Basically, it's a not-for-profit organisation. It started 1 year after AussieCon, and basically, at the end of AussieCon, there was a lot of enthusiasm for conventions for promoting science fiction in Australia, and we're looking at ways of developing this and promoting SF, and the foundation came out of that. It was set up as a not-for-profit cooperative with the Victorian government. We had about 20 or 30 members, and we did a range of activities which continues to today. Early on, one of our main activities was providing seed funding or loans to conventions. Because a lot of conventions after us, a lot of small conventions, one of the biggest things, they would have initial costs in terms of deposits on venue and publicity material. And at the start of the convention, they had very little cash flow. So the foundation came in and would lend them money to get the convention up and running, and we did this over the years 15, 20 times.
Mm, that's terrific. And it's still running today.
It's still running today.
That's terrific. All right, thanks for that. We hadn't done that before. All right, so we're now going to run run with a series of interviews with people that we've recorded over the last couple of months. The first one is actually one that Perry did with Kerry before Perry went overseas. So we'll start with that shortly. After that, we've got we'll hear from Perry himself from his interview that we recorded before he went. Then we'll bring on Lee Edmonds and finish up with a longtime fan and fanzine publisher Bruce Gillespie. So for the time being, here's Kerry.
Kerry, you did a lot of work on the committee for AussieCon. What position did you hold and what sort of work did you do?
I was basically in charge of the membership division, and this involved processing pre-registrations from the 2 years prior to when we won the bid, and then processing registration at the convention. Looking back on that, one of the things that strikes me is the changes in technology. At the time, and it still applies now, majority of our members came from the United States. And the majority of them were supporting memberships. And basically, a supporting membership is where someone joins the Worldcon to support the Worldcon, and it gives them right to vote in the Hugo and vote in site selection. So back in AussieCon 1 in the 1975, processing memberships, the highlight of my week, I would get an air letter from our American agent, and it would have 10, 20 memberships, people to join during the week. And basically, my role was to process these memberships. Now, we're talking about 1973, 74. There was no internet. There was no email. There was no computer. Well, computers, but no PCs.
There wouldn't be any personal computers.
No personal computers. So basically, it was all manual processing. we did get our membership onto a database, and basically it had to be a mainframe. We didn't have access or any budget for a mainframe, so it was run through one of our helpers who basically worked for one of the internationals, and he maintained our database on their mainframe outside office hours without permission. This came to a head when it was finally discovered, and he was quietly told that his services were no longer needed.
Really?
At the time, this wasn't a big issue because he was planning on moving on anyway. So he said, fine. So,
Okay. Wasn't as if it was going to be a massive amount of information massive amount of computing.
Look, it wasn't a massive amount of information.
So it was the principle of the thing.
It was the principle of the thing. And, you know, I would send information to him, and sort of once a month he'd go in after work or on the weekend and into the data, into the things, and we get use it for sort of printouts of our membership records, which was on that huge computer paper at the time.
Yep.
Come in real piles. We used it to money labels and things like that.
So that would have saved you a lot of time in mailing labels.
Oh, look, it did. And sort of it gave us, you know, ready access to sort of information like membership numbers and address and stuff like that. So it was well worth doing.
Well, it's a good job you didn't get fired before.
I know.
Before the convention happened.
Yes. Yeah,
so that was all the lead-in, basically all the memberships coming through and at the convention itself?
At the convention itself, the whole process went fairly smoothly, although, as I mentioned, my memory of it is a bit like controlled chaos. So I was working behind the scenes with the rest of the committee to make sure things happen when they should happen, and there was the odd hiccups and stuff like that. But in terms of the membership processing, it went fairly smoothly. Other memories of the convention, there are two or three highlights. One thing I remember in particular, I don't know if you remember, we had some very special AV presentations, both at the opening ceremony and key bits during the convention. And that still ticks in my memory, because basically at the time it was done by a professional marketing advertising man who had all the equipment and happened to be a science fiction fan.
Okay.
And he came in and volunteered his services, brought in all his equipment, and he set up a series of AVs based both on using our logos and a lot of science fiction themes. So science fiction art, the Hugos, cover from Pulps and things like that. And we're talking a really impressive thing. So it was screens that sort of filled the back of a hall and worked really well. And we'd seen nothing like this before. I know a couple of the local conventions in Perth had put on minor things like a slideshow, similar effect, but this was a level over and above that. And I think it was one of the first four Worldcons. I know several Worldcons after AussieCon took that idea and did a similar version.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so we were setting the pace.
Good to hear.
The other thing that sticks in my memory is the program. I didn't get to any program items, but we had a couple of rather interesting topics. One in particular, the title of the panel was The Role of Sheep in Science Fiction.
Oh, I remember that one. Actually remember that. Now that you bring it up, well, it was all about Cordwainer Smith and all that.
Well, it was. Obvious things about Cordwainer Smith and Struan and his gigantic sheep, the discussions about John Brunner and Sheep Look Up.
Oh, yeah.
But the other fascinating thing was it's actually moderated by a fan, John Lawson, who actually happened to be a sheep farmer. So,
good choice of panellists in that situation.
Definitely.
That's what we'd like to hear.
Yeah.
That was good.
The other thing that sticks in my memory is Ursula's Guest of Honor speech. That was a really major event, really awe-inspiring. She was talking about the state of science fiction at the time, and this is 1975, and she's talking about changing from traditional past where it was male-dominated and rocket ships and spacemen and aliens to something a lot more inclusive with female writers like herself and a growing number of writers.
It's got pretty much legendary status these days, hasn't it?
Has.
I always remember the line she sort of pretty much ends with, I think, which is, it's time we put Philip K. Dick back on the shelf next to
Charles Dickens. Yes, instead of... Yeah.
So in a separate section for sci-fi. And she was talking about literature and treating science fiction as literature.
Well, the weird thing that I found out about Le Guin and Philip K. Dick is they were both went to the same high school.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. This is really peculiar. They were. Right. I don't know whether they were in classes together or whether they knew each other there, but later on somebody determined they were at the same high school at the same time.
Okay.
Somewhere in California. That's amazing. That's really peculiar.
Yeah. Yeah.
So thanks, Kerry. Now let's hear from Perry.
Ozzycon was the first convention I ever went to. In 1975, early 70s, I was a university student living in Adelaide. Must have been sometime in 74, I would guess, that I first heard about the convention, probably from reading about it in the back of one of my father's professional science fiction magazines, and that was probably Analog, because that was the major one that he read. And I happened to be passing through Melbourne in January 1975 and dropped into Space Age Books and picked up a couple of flyers, which included membership forms. So I filled one out for myself and my father, and we decided that we would attend Ozzycon in Melbourne, August 1975 at the Southern Cross Hotel, the late lamented Southern Cross Hotel. We travelled over from Adelaide overnight, sitting up on the train, a decision that we instantly regretted and unfortunately had to do again on the way back. We didn't stay at the hotel because we basically didn't have that much money, I don't suppose. We stayed at a friend of my father's. I have no idea where that was. It's completely gone from me now. I don't know what suburb it was. I don't know who those people were. But anyway, we stayed with some friends of my father's and we travelled in and out each day to the convention. Probably went along to all of the panel items that we could get our hands on, wandered around the dealer's room and the art show, wondering at all the stuff that was floating around there, and basically just gawking at everything as you do at your first ever convention. It was a pretty wonderful thing seeing all these people that were science fiction readers and fans. I knew my father, I knew me, a couple of my friends from university read it. I knew there was an Adelaide University Science Fiction Association, but hadn't really got a hold of it before, or hadn't really got involved with it until I was there in 1975 at university. And so we had a good time floating around, so catching up with everything. Saw Bob Silverberg, went to the Hugo Awards banquet and saw John Benson jumping up and down. I remember Bruce Gillespie from then. I remember Robin Johnson, of course, because he was the chair of the convention and he was introducing a lot of things all over the place. But it was an excellent convention, an excellent time. I really enjoyed my time there and it basically changed my life. I've now been to probably 10, 12 Worldcons around the world, and I've probably got another couple coming up and hopefully a fair number more, but we'll just have to see. I've probably been to 40, 50 science fiction conventions overall. I've made a very large number of friends from science fiction fandom. I've got friends all around the world and I can drop into pretty much any fanish city anywhere and know that there'll be somebody there that I know. And that's all because of Ozzycon right at the very beginning. Right back there in 1975 when I first went along and found out what this crazy, funny community of science fiction fans was all about.
And what would you say was the long-term impact of the convention on Australian science fiction, Barry?
Well, immediately after the convention, I didn't really know whether there was going to be much of an impact, but it certainly changed very rapidly afterwards, 1976, 1977. Things moved very, very quickly. Conventions started springing up all over the place. I started to get more involved in fandom in Adelaide. I got to meet a large number of people that I've remained friendly with for the rest of my life. I still see a lot of these people that I met early. Some of them have passed on, so they're no longer around. And some of them have drifted off. Some of them have. Some of the friends that I made way back then are no longer in science fiction fandom. They probably still read, but they aren't going to conventions and aren't involved. That's okay. I've still remained involved. I've still remained active in conventions, where I was up until about 2010. I attend them now. I don't do any more work on them. I've got to the point where I've had quite enough, thanks very much. But I still attend conventions because of the impact that AussieCon had on me. I was, for a long period of time, I was in a number of appers around Australia. I produced my own fanzines, both in Adelaide and then in Melbourne when I finally moved down here in the mid-1980s. But Australia overall, I don't think Australian fandom would have existed without the first AussieCon. I don't think AussieCon 2, 3 or 4 would have happened without that first one. Maybe one of them might have turned up at some point later on. I'm not sure. But I can certainly tell you that AussieCon was a big push for Australian fandom and has been and has remained a big push for Australian fandom for the whole of the, what is it now, 44 years since it was held. It was a major event in the science fiction community in Australia.
And that was Perry Middlemiss talking about his experiences of AussieCon. And now we'll talk to Lee Edmonds, who's an old friend who has been a science fiction fan for many a long year and is a historian. We heard from Lee in our fifth episode. And this is an interview I did with him when he was here in Melbourne for the Continuum Science Fiction Convention held over the Queen's Birthday weekend. You went overseas as the first DAF candidate, the Fan Fund candidate which year was that?
DISCON 2 in 74.
So by that stage Australia had already won the bid.
Yeah, we won the bid, and so we had a little table. Robin Johnson, of course, was the chairman, and I'm normally the vice chairman, though I don't know why. So on the main area gala, remember more about the DISCON 2 than I do about AussieCon. On the main runway down into the convention area itself, we had a little table where we were selling memberships. And so just about anyone who went to this Worldcon in DC walked past our table. And so Velma and I and Robin and various other people sat there and manned this table throughout the length of the convention. The person I remember the most was Pete Weston, a well-known British fan. It's the only time I ever came across him. And he only died recently, but he's well-known in Britain, but I think he was the TAF winner that year. And so we had a lot more in common, although TAF had a much greater tradition in those years than DAF did. So that was part of the promotion of AussieCon that had gone on in Australia since 1970 when Australian fans decided they'd bid for a Worldcon. So after that, really, see, fandom in Australia is at the most 50 people. 50 active people. There is a whole bunch of other people. There's a history of fandom studies has a word for it that doesn't come to mind now, who are not participants but provide the numbers at conventions and pay subscriptions to things, who actually make up the numbers. So when you get 400 people at AussieCon, most of those are walk-ins who just pay the membership. So anyhow, we've been promoting this thing, and so me and Val are going to DISCON 2 was part of that promotion. DAF had been set up to promote AussieCon. John Foyster's idea, we bring an Australian, we bring an American fan to Australia, they write up, they introduce people to, there's the Aussie fan film. All these things come together. And so in 1973, Australian Melbourne fandom won the bid to run AussieCon in 1975. Now, what actually happened at AussieCon? I don't have much of a memory.
Mm-hmm.
I only met Palmer 4 years before, and we're going to every social and cultural event in Melbourne you could lay your hands on, and producing fanzines as if they were going out of fashion. My one memory of, memory of actually being there rather than remembering, is actually standing at the bottom stairs. When you walked into the Southern Cross, there were stairs going up and down. Just standing at the stairs and thinking to myself, well, it's here. It's happened. What we've been thinking about for 5 years is here. And sort of this vague sort of, well, I wonder what will happen next. But in the meantime, we've got this four-day event to go through. So I've got another memory of having left the convention to go to a dark room and putting pies into the pie warmer for the pie night that we thought of. I have vague memories of seeing the area where the Wang computers were where there was some kind of space game set up on these Wang computers, and the notorious Wang girls that Bill Wright's told me in glorious detail about. I remember more about before and after, because I think before it must have been we had Susan Wood and John Berry stay at our place for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. And then after the convention, we had Bob Tucker and Rusty Heavlin stay at our place for 2 or 3 days. And I know that 2 days after AussieCon, we took them down to Rosebud because of
Bob Tucker's
famous Rosebud story. Mm-hmm. And had a convention. Well, it wasn't a convention. We went down with 3 or 4 other people and sat around the table, had dinner, and we called it lunch, and we called it Rosebud Con. So I remember that there was a party, and it might have been the day after AussieCon, at which all the luminaries turned up at Bauma and my place, and the Magic Pudding Club in Carlton hosted everyone else, basically as a distraction so people didn't feel as if they were being excluded. I remember might have been the Hugo presentations, where John Forst interrupted to give the cricket scores, because this is 1975 when Dennis Lilly and Jeff Thompson are in the Australian bowling team. And so everyone in Australia was interested in the Ashes that year. And really, those are my memories of it.
No, that's fair enough.
It wasn't so much an anticlimax as you spent 5 years building up something and it's there.
Yes.
And it happens and it becomes a blur. You know, I remember bumping into someone who was famous in the lift well.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing the daily newsletter. We didn't have a duplicator. There was no photocopying machines in 75.
Mm-hmm.
So every morning I got on the tram back to our place in St Kilda and typed it up and fed the cats and ran it off, and then went back into the convention. Oh, wow. So I think I must have missed 2 or 3 hours every morning doing that.
Mm.
I think there were some parties. Oh, look, I remember that maybe where my lack of interest in parties started, because there are fascinating people there, but you have to yell at them. So there were room parties. There were all kinds. In fact, the room parties were more interesting, but the individual conversations in which what is more important is that you've talked to someone than what you talked about.
Mm.
So that, for example, chatting to Robert Silverberg. See, I didn't know that Robert Silverberg had once been a fan rather than a writer. And so when Lee Harding and Robert Silverberg talked to each other, they talked to each other as people who'd corresponded as fans in the early 1950s. I don't think I got to say even a word to Ursula Le Guin. Certainly talked to Mike Glickson and Susan Wood. They were divorced at that stage, but they had separated.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been chosen as guests of honour because in 1973, their fanzine was the best being fanzine produced anywhere. Even these days, it's fabulous.
What was the name of the fanzine?
Don't ask me.
Energuman?
No, that's someone else's. So they'd been chosen as fan guests of honour because they were well known, big name fans. They were still big name fans, but they were separate. So when they came out, Mike Glickson came out with Cheryl Burkhead, and Susan came out with John Berry. And so I remember talking to individuals about things that I don't remember what I talked about anymore, because it really wasn't important what I talked about. What it was an opportunity for fans in Australia who are separated by the Pacific Ocean or the Asian European mainland from Britain to spend 4 days acting as if they were North American fans or as if American fans were Australian fans. And it's the kind of thing these days that you can do very easily. But in those days, it was a little precious gem. So what I remember overall is, in fact, this feeling of this thing that we'd made and it happened. But, of course, like all temporal things, it just disappears into the past. So if I'm lucky, I can, in the final chapter, conclude by talking about AussieCon. Various people wrote their recollections of it afterwards, and I might have to read those to be reminded. So, in fact, the history will end, because although it's a history of fandom, it's got to involve science fiction. So the history will finish with Ursula Le Guin's speech at AussieCon, where she talked about the ghetto of science fiction. It was also the ghetto of science fiction fandom, and how she said we should open the gates and let them in. That means the mundane world in. And that's what happened. It wasn't through actually written science fiction. It was through Star Wars happened, what, 2 years later. Star Trek keeps going. The whole series of, in particular, visual science fiction happens. So that the nature, what happens, of course, is it changes the nature of science fiction, it changes the nature of fandom. One of the reasons I'm not continuing beyond 75, it just becomes too complicated after then. Before then, I can tell a unified story. I can't afterwards. So, yeah, OzzyCon is this little jewel. Remember in Men in Black? At the end, they're looking for this universe, and it's in this little ball. Sort of OzzyCon is that little ball to me, in which I was a universe and I've forgotten most of what's in the universe.
That's very good. Okay, now we're going to hear from Bruce Gillespie, who starts with a description of his long overseas trip in the lead-up to OzzyCon, where he went to the United States and to the UK and met with a great number of science fiction fans and science fiction writers. He ended up staying in the UK with Christopher Priest. And then Bruce talks about OzzyCon itself and its legacy. So here's Bruce.
So we're here, we're in the early 70s now.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole of the OzzyCon thing is starting to tick over. Somebody's come up with the idea that it should be a good idea. No,
it was all very specifically... John Bankson saw a suggestion by Andy. It's all NISFR, if somebody would put it up on the, because the whole story is there, of course, is that Andy Porter made a jokey suggestion somewhere in 66 or 67. John Bankson took it up, floated around for a few years. John Foister said, we're going to do this. At the 69 convention, he said, we'll give you a year to decide whether you, as Australian fandom, want to go ahead with this. 1970, he came. 1970 Easter Convention. Okay, we're going ahead. This is the committee. Typical. Nobody voting on anything.
He just appointed them, did he?
So off we went, and the main campaign. The only way we could campaign was either letters or fanzines. Or as approved, the Aussie fan film, which was made in 1972, which actually proved to be the real clincher, because the film made by John Litchin, with every lot of Melbourne fans in it.
Yes.
Have you ever had it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Okay, well that went to...
Well, it's available on YouTube now.
Yes, I know now because...
I got
it because I had a copy on DVD, which I was able to lend to whoever
put it up there, okay, yep.
But we're heading ahead. Basically, the main effort went into fanzines. And so Foister himself started in Australian News. So we had finally had an Australian, regular Australian news magazine, which we hadn't had up till then. And he counted up, I think in 71, Australian fans produced, apart from APPA's, 106 different issues of fanzines of one sort or another, which were sent overseas.
Right.
So
that's quite a wave, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And everybody, even people who really didn't enjoy doing fanzines, at least tried one or two, you know, to keep going. And then we had our first female fan, Shane McCormack, coming with something else. And this was the other huge change. I mean, the only women who went to conventions up to the early 70s were wives or girlfriends of fans. I mean, that's how it worked. Then suddenly in 1970, I think, at the Easter Convention, two unaccompanied women, the Star Trek fans, were Shane McCormack and Sabina Haggie from Sydney. So and of course, we have to thank Star Trek fandom for a lot.
Yes.
But the change was so rapid that by the Easter Convention in 73, now that's, you had, well, certainly wasn't half women, but it was much, much larger percentage.
Mm.
And a lot to do with science fiction becoming popular with teachers, So one of Lee Harding's better, he had an entire day for teachers of science, teachers who were teaching science fiction in schools, to do a special session. It wasn't part of the convention, but that brought in a lot of people as well. Because okay. It all yep. ties up again with Merv Binns having to, with the Melbourne Science Fiction Club having to leave its facilities at the end of 1970 because they were running, the Fantasy Film Group was running 35 mil, what's the...
acetate?
Yeah, the old films.
Yeah.
Upstairs, almost no escape. Anybody, fire hazard, with people who...
Smoking all over the place. Yeah.
It's extraordinary that one of the films didn't go up.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And one of the members of the club actually reported them to the council because he was a projectionist and he knew what the date was.
He was horrified by what he saw,
So they were chucked out of the... of the facilities, and suddenly Merv had to do something besides simply stay at McGill's. So he and the club, what did he do? Oh, he was lent some money. Well, a lot of us were helped by Ron Graham in Sydney, who was a rich businessman who really had all sorts of interest in science fiction, but the main thing is he did like to help fans to do things, and he helped me with a typewriter at one stage. But what he did was loan, sort of permanent loan, whatever, to Merv to start Space Age Books, which Merv had always wanted to do. And originally it was just a couple of rooms in one of the old buildings, the Beehive building at the south of Swanston Street. And then they were able to take facilities in early 71 up Swanston Street. And that was the original space. I think there's a photo of the original Space Age that I found. Okay, Space Age then is a central area for... virtually takes over from the club as a place where people can meet.
More centralised because it was right in the middle of the city.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Yep.
So you've got everything centralised around Space Age, a huge amount of activity going on. The club took a while to find a home. At one stage, it was a flat that was Paul Stevens and John Breeden were living in, and... you know, he had all the books along the corridor or whatever. Because it was the library. It's always been the Melbourne Science Fiction Club's library has been their chief asset.
Yes.
As it still is, and they don't know what to do with it. But anyway.
So in terms of space of commentary, with Space Age Books, presumably somewhere you'd be able to distribute?
I put a few copies in. No, it was still basically mail and getting good reviews. See, I'd been asked to be... Locus's agent in Australia, and they were my agent over there, and we had this exchange deal, and I was getting as much money in for subscriptions to them as they were getting for me. And there's one stage in which I think maybe even the magazine might even have been making its costs back, but a very short period, I would have thought, somewhere in the early 70s. Okay, so we're coming up to 75, but in the meanwhile, we wanted to bid. We had to bid at 73, 2 years before. So I took the time off. Well, it was more than time off. I actually had to resign from the department to do my overseas trip.
Okay.
Whereas if I'd done it a year before, I wouldn't have. I could have had continuous employment. When I came back, I could have simply stepped back into the position. So I set off and I did my... Claude Degler, and basically starting off at Torcon, which was the Toronto convention where we won the bid, but there were about 25 Australians there, and we had huge support from the people in Canada for basically Mike Glickson.
Yes.
And we'd already asked, of course, Mike and Susan to be our guests of honour, our fan guests of honour when we won. And we it was just a foregone conclusion, but we conducted it as a proper campaign. And that's what... But a lot of the campaigning, in quotation marks, was done in the year before because the Aussie fan film had gone over to America. Jack Chalker, who was then a freelance small press publisher. I think you'd have to... I keep forgetting. I just can't remember the name of his press. Was going all over America. Almost every weekend he hit a convention. He took the film with him. He showed it in his room almost continually throughout the whole convention for something like 30 or 40 weeks out of that year.
So everybody, yes. Everybody that wanted to see it got a chance to see that's it right. Everywhere. And sometimes multiple. I don't know how the
print survived.
So this would be on a little projector.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a video.
No, he'd have his little projector. And he'd, yeah.
Dedication for you. Taking us.
Well, there's so many people so enthusiastic for Australia and they're looking forward to the trip as well. I mean, that's the thing.
It's a pretty exotic trip for them at that stage. Yes, and it was, yes. There weren't a lot of people doing a lot of long overseas hauls at that stage.
And airfares were much higher in real terms because when I left publications, I got my full super and it was a princely sum of $700. It was the exact airfare I needed for my overseas trip. Yes. But $700 then is equivalent to about $8,000 or $9,000 now. And this was just for an ordinary seat.
Yeah.
So all these people who were came out, and there are only a bit over 140, I think, overseas people actually came to AussieCon in 75, but they really were sacrificing quite a bit to get here. Okay, 73, I arrived and basically invited to stay at various people's places all over the East Coast. I didn't get to the West Coast. And finally, I was too ambitious. I basically, there was a period in which I suddenly decided I just can't stand travelling anymore, even though I thought, what was I, 28 or something? I should have. Okay, I got to that stage and I fronted up to the airline office in Chicago and said, I want to go back to Australia. And he said, have you looked at your ticket? This is the ticket that Robin Johnson arranged.
Yes.
It says you have to keep going. You can only go one way around the world. Yeah. And you have to go. You have to take the British part of the ticket. Well, there was a problem because I'd already sent my major bag back to Australia. Anyway, so, okay, well, we'll have to do it that way. So I got on the plane to England. I forget how I arranged it. A grey boat picked me up at the airport. Oh, no, I got it. That's right. I got in, and then I started phoning people at Heathrow because there wasn't even the railway at that stage. There wasn't the tube into London. Okay, so I arrived in London, and then it was extraordinary. It was January 1974. It was the three-day weekend. It was January in London, so it rained virtually every day. And I still had a great time because I stayed first with Malcolm Edwards out at Harrow when he was a lowly librarian. He wasn't head of Orion or whatever he eventually ended up. Can't believe.
Yeah.
I mean, Malcolm and I and our fanzines are virtually the same. We write the same way. We have the same interests, Philip K. Dick fans.
He goes one way. Well, sometimes it's just a matter of where you are and being in the right place at the right time.
Well, the point is he was already doing reviews for John Bush. Book reports for John Bush at Golang's.
Oh, yeah.
So he had he was already in with Golang's. Anyway, I stayed with them. Then I stayed with Pete and Eileen Weston in Birmingham for a week.
Yes.
And they were wonderful. And who else? Oh, the best one was the last week was staying with Chris Priest back in London. And the last day, I was just getting all packed up. A phone call from Brian Aldiss. He said, is Bruce still in England? He said, yeah. Oh, come up to Oxford for the day. So Chris, of course, being a freelance author, we both got on his mini. We went off to Oxford and we visited old Brian. He said, do you want to go and see Stonehenge? So we then hit and it was for most of the day. It was the only sunny day we got in the whole trip. The whole month I was in England. So we went to Stonehenge and there was a photo. Well, see if you. The photo of it is actually in part one of the 50th anniversary edition.
Yes.
Okay, so that was one of the great days, and off I went back to Australia. Mm. But after 5 months of. I can't even imagine how it.
5 months you were gone for.
Well, the point is that because the 2 years I was back in Melbourne, I was staying with my parents, and they wouldn't accept more than a token amount of rent or whatever. So I was stacking it into the, even though I was doing the magazine, I was stacking it in the bank. So I had enough money to do the whole trip. You know, I had to sometimes, it worked really well, but okay, so that's how I met Harry Warner Jr. and Buck Coulson and Juanita. Juanita sort of had a vague memory of me when she visited a couple of years ago. Who else? Roger and Judy Zelazny. Of course, then they split up and then Roger died.
Yeah.
I did have a rather ill effect on her because I stayed in the middle of Kansas with Ed and Sue Cagle. And they, well, Ed died only a couple of years later. He was only 40 when he died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And
this is all your fault, was it?
He was beginning.
The fanish pariah working his way across the States.
But thanks to, say, Jackie Frank's no longer with us. She died of lung cancer about 10 years ago. But anyway, she took a group of us to see Bob Tucker, and that was a rare privilege. That is... an evening with Tucker. That's how I came to the... You couldn't visit Tucker without doing the smooth thing. Yes, that's the first time I tasted spirits. You couldn't not.
No, the Jim Beam was flying all over the place. Right. About 75 at the convention, as I recall, when he came out. So why was why Le Guin in 1975? She hadn't been.
Oh, now that's not the question to ask. The question to ask is why Le Guin, when she'd only been publishing, as far as most people had noticed, for about 5 or 6 years. Because what we didn't know as a AussieCon, because we wanted to run our own show and not be particularly influenced by Americans, what we didn't know is the unwritten rule that a Worldcon guest of honour usually has 20 or 30 years under the belt.
Yes.
We didn't know that.
Oh, okay.
And we didn't know that the same thing happened to fan guests of honour. So we went with the people who were, well, I mean, I didn't have much to do with the decision because it was very much John Bankson's and the rest of the committee because I came in much later. But that she was just the best science fiction writer in the world, which she was and remained so. And it was just seemed so obvious to us that she was the one person we really wanted to have as a guest of honour.
In hindsight, it was a fantastic choice when you basically go from the fact that, you know, a couple of years earlier she'd written Lieutenant Darkness, and in the year of 1975... her other major great novel, The Dispossessed, is up for the Hugo, and it bloody well wins it.
Yeah, yes.
That's the major thing, and that was just quite astounding.
Yeah.
I don't know whether... I'd have to do a check on this. I don't know if any other Worldcon guest of honour has won the Hugo in that year that they've
been there. Well, there's very good reason for that, because usually their career is pretty well over, because they've been given basically, which we didn't realise, a lifetime award rather than being the hot item. See, the thing is, we'd gone with a person we thought was by far the best. I don't know. The other person whose work we really enjoyed, of course, was Aldous, and I'm not sure whether any approach was made to him or not. I have no idea of that. That's why...
Robin mentioned that he was keen on James Blish.
Ah, yes,
did
yes.
Did that come up as a discussion point?
But I wasn't involved. So you say I was on the committee, that I sort of slipped on right at the end because people kept dropping off. I mean, Foister did this thing of, I'm not going to have anything to do with America because they're bombing Haiphong, and dropped out of FAPA. He wouldn't have anything to do with American APAs because he was in three or four of them, and he dropped out of the AussieCon committee, even though he provided, and suddenly... It was left to, well, basically to Robin Johnson. And Robin, I think, found all sorts of abilities he had no idea he had until it was dropped.
Just dropped in his lap and said,
pretty much so.
Here it is, get on with it.
I mean, Bankson's great support, but, you know, Bankson doesn't get things done, or he didn't in those days. I mean, he had fabulous ideas, but it was left to people like Robin who could... just do the vast amount of donkey work, which is... So they dragged me in at a very late stage, and even at one, I think for a few weeks or something, I was even vice chair or something, because nobody else wanted it. But I wasn't privy to any of the decisions.
Okay.
But the main thing was that I was given the job of doing the writer's workshop.
Okay.
So how
did that come about? How did you get to the point of being given that job? Was it just the one that you put your hand up for?
No, or? I didn't put it. I was just sort of, you were it, sort of.
You happened to be the one standing when everybody else sat down.
Well, I said, well, I've no idea how to organise this, but Kerry Hanfield knows how to organise things, so we basically formed a team. And our first, the first job, of course, was to get government money. Yeah, and Bankson had a lot to do with that, was putting in the application, because we couldn't go ahead unless we could get enough so that people could afford to go to it, because we were going to have accommodation, all the rest of it. And in fact, that's what worked when that money came through. Then we had to find the accommodation. And Kerry and I were floating around the hills of the Dandenong Ranges, and we found this wonderful place which had been given to us by an travel agency or somebody, called Booth Lodge, which is not run by the Salvation Army, but by the Church of England. But it's absolutely perfect for a winter convention. It was properly heated and beautifully compact. And as soon as we saw the place, we knew this is it. If we can afford it, if we can afford to subsidise people who are... And of course, the next one was to put out the applications. Now, we didn't... We used the fan press to a certain extent, but the fan press is pretty unreliable. What we basically used was the Society of Editors in Sydney, because, again, Bankson had these connections with the person who was running Society of Editors. And then I had the connection with Jim Hamilton, who worked at Publications, who was the equivalent. Writers organisation, which was pretty strong in Victoria and may still be, but so there was an ad in their little fortnightly leaflet, and then there was an ad, and most of the people who applied came out of those, not out of fandom.
Okay.
And nearly everybody who was there were people we hadn't met before. Mm. There were a few of us we had, David and Rob and
Derek Ashby.
Yeah, Derek Ashby, but just, yeah, most of them were new. And, of course, did stay in fandom afterwards. Mm-hmm. Okay, what they had to do, each applicant had to send in a story. The real technological problem is that photocopying was in a pretty primitive stage. You had to have this gigantic spirit of a photocopier, which causes no end of trouble for...
Yeah, not very reliable, and
well, not so much that, it's just big, huge, yeah. And big, and required lots of the fluid to run it. But this is where I was left. Basically, everybody organised the whole thing around me because I was hopeless at organising. So the people at the Magic Pudding Club, which was a slant shack, a group of fans who had gathered together. It was Don Ashby and whatever girlfriend he was with, his brother Derek, there are two or three other people who were, Ken Ford, staying at this place in Drummond Street. Basically, it was a permanent party, which was also a place where people tried to sleep and tried to work from.
All right.
Well, wherever Don was, people wanted to be, and so they were calling it anyway. But they were incredibly helpful. They just sort of... And David, I can remember David did a huge amount for photocopying. Because we had to photocopy the original stories, send them over to Ursula to pick out the people who would be in the workshop. That was the easy job. But once we'd done that, then we had to have copies for every other... Once we had, I think it was 20 people, and they all had to have copies, and they had to have them on the first day, in the first minute they arrived, the first thing they were supposed to be handed with it. And while we were waiting for Ursula, who didn't arrive till the next morning, they were busily reading their stories. But the problems of running that photocopier, if it hadn't had to be... Okay, so we were... Ursula Rye, well, the thing is, I've always said Ursula is the best teacher I've ever seen working, because she said so little. She was, I mean, okay, she had this gravitas, you know, we all worshipped or whatever, but it didn't matter. She was there, and if things got a bit offside in discussing, she could correct them and get, but that's basically
just, she, just bring, yeah, just shepherd it and bring it back on course. Yeah,
very good at getting everybody else to do, or really put a lot of work into, well, you've got to critique the stories and then write something by you know, by the following day.
Yep.
And people were staying up to 2 and 3 in the morning writing there. But the sheer energy level, that is the closest I think I've ever been to something you call a group mind, of just people being totally, you know, connected by the common task.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact it was only a week. I mean, people talk about this 6 week, the usual Clarion, the model for the whole thing, of course, is the Clarion workshop method from America. But 6 weeks of this would leave you utterly exhausted. I just can't imagine doing all these. Even though each teacher, there's one teacher every week for the Clarion method, for the people undergoing. I mean, some people would just thrive on it, would develop, and we know so many graduates of overseas Clarions have been successful. It's obviously a very successful way of doing things.
Yes. Difficult though.
Yes.
So what happened from AussieCon? Basically, well, there was a large number of people from all around the world came to, well, 600. So for us at that time,
AussieCon 4 was only about 120 from overseas. It was only 450 total.
Okay.
It was the smallest WorldCon
for
a very long time.
Yeah.
Especially as TorCon in Toronto had been well over 2,000 was then the biggest convention, and then the following year in Los Angeles was many vast numbers.
Yes.
So, you know, but they were the people who were willing to come. Now, the thing in Australian fandom, the real change in Australian fandom was by one person, John Bankson, who was a representative for Methuen, who took his magazine and he put it in newsagents in Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide and Perth, and each of those produced a fan group. And I mean, Eric saw it in Sydney, John Ryan, I think, in Brisbane, the people who became people like Alan Sandico and the people who, Jeff Harris, saw it in Adelaide.
Mm-hmm.
So those people, so you had the club started then. So when you're getting AussieCon, of course, all those clubs could be fully activated and were. So you get an enormous amount of enthusiasm from those clubs. And it was the build-up of enthusiasm was what really led to so much energy in the 70s. But, of course, then there are all the people who came in for in Australia who came in for the first time.
Hmm.
Well, two I know are Gene Webber. There was you. I mean, you probably know. Well, it's probably if... Mark Ordley didn't get to AussieCon. There's some story, he didn't join fandom until a year later or something.
Yeah, so I'll check that. I'm not entirely sure. But I think that, well, I don't want to speak for Mark, but I know that he was around very soon. He says he was at
AussieCon. Oh, okay, right.
So
okay.
Maybe that was his kicker. Maybe he was a bit like me and didn't know anybody there when you first turned up, and everything changed after that.
Well, the other problem Elaine said, who was in a slain shack at that stage, said they were all doing their science exams. What nobody in the convention committee is that the university, they failed to get a lot of university students because they were doing exams that week.
Yeah.
And she also says that they'd all joined and they didn't get their Hugo nomination.
ballots.
Elaine will bring this up.
So basically there was you saw a flow on suddenly.
Oh, enormous flow.
In the next couple of years there was more conventions for one thing. So that then brings
And then you're getting far more fanzines around Australia. But far more conventions around Australia, that's what really.
Yeah. And then there was more fanzines, more appers, more.
Well, that's right. You get all sorts of sites, some of which I've never seen. Of course, Apple Sauce, I don't think I've ever seen it. In Sydney,
I was a member of that for a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's very active.
Yep.
In fact, Irwin once put together this was 20 years ago, he could put together a list of 13 Australian appers, which many of which I'd never heard of.
But obviously there was a great explosion, and it certainly brought a large number of people into the into the field.
And also there's, I was going to say it affected professional, but it didn't really, because the big publishers stayed away from science fiction. I mean, for instance, the main interest that was shown in AussieCon from outside was the ABC. We brought in a team and interviewed lots of people, did, I'd say, 20 or 30 hours of stuff, but in the end it was boiled down to 1 hour on radio. So what happened to their archives, I don't know. That is a fantastic. I'm sure they interviewed most of the authors who came in.
And, it would have been interesting to find out whether that's
very little in newspapers. This is a continuing theme of Australian, especially Melbourne conventions, are hopeless at getting publicity. Because, you know, you get all these supernovas and the Comic-Cons and whatever, they can get publicity, but...
Yeah, I think in that instance, though, it's more a matter of the cosplay that people are going to have a look at and sort of dressing up. But if you go and have a look on Trove, on the internet, there is a scan of an issue of Australian Women's Weekly where it has an article about Le Guin in it.
Right.
So if you go into Trove and have a look at either Le Guin or AussieCon, it's tagged, probably by me, because I came across it somewhere. So that is there. That was in Australian
Women's
Weekly.
The other person who was always interested in what we were doing was, I think he'd been an SF reader, and it was Keith Dunstan, and he used to cover every convention. He did it in his A Place in the Sun.
Oh, okay. It's a little column in the Herald?
Was it in
the Sun.
Yeah.
Okay, well... Sun Herald, became newspaper later on, but...
Later on, yes, but they're very distinct papers at
that stage.
So, okay, Le Guin certainly got...
some publicity, but there wasn't a huge amount of it, no.
No,
that's right.
We found very hard to push through to... But there were people I've heard since who've said, well, we heard about it, but we nearly went, you know. Mm. So then, I don't know, I just didn't... There wasn't we didn't have the money for advertising as such. That's the thing. We got some publicity, but I can't remember much advertising. Maybe posters in Space Age was probably the nearest we got to. And so many people remember Space Age. Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Kerry. Thanks, listeners. Thanks for being with us. Please join us in another couple of weeks for our next episode, when my co-host Perry Middlemist ought to be back, and we'll talk perhaps a little bit about his experiences at the Dublin Worldcon and Worldcons in general, and also talk about books and movies once more. Thanks. Please join us then. Bye.